The U.S. pledged $150 million to help Pakistanis devastated by this summer's flood.
But Special Representative Richard Holbrooke says don't confuse that money with the billions the U.S. normally sends to Pakistan.
Pakistan is uniquely important to our own interests. That's not why we're here today, however. We're here for a relief effort of, as everyone has said, epic proportion.
But what if we didn't make such a big distinction between flood relief and normal aid to Pakistan?
Flood relief could be a model for our future relationship with Pakistan.
Maybe the billions that we've pledged will only mean something if the Pakistanis see us spending it there.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Thursday, September 16th. I mean, we always learn from how we deal with crises, right? I mean, you're supposed to at least, right?
Well, flood relief could have some unforeseen benefits in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's get a check of the morning's top news right off the bat. If you're drinking your morning coffee, are you behind on your bills, folks? Here's a milestone. More homes were foreclosed on last month than in any month since the start of the housing crisis.
Foreclosure activity increased by 4% in the month of August, with almost 339,000 U.S. households receiving a foreclosure notice during the month.
A huge number. That's RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga, who says it's a 25% increase from just a year ago. There's a 10% unemployment rate. Couple those numbers and you get a hostile political atmosphere of what to do about the lagging economy. Go to Washington now. The latest fight is whether the Bush-era tax cuts for the rich should be extended. President Obama says doing so defies common sense.
They want to hold these middle class tax cuts hostage until they get an additional tax cut for the wealthiest 2% of Americans.
But 30 congressional Democrats want to keep the tax cuts in place. House Minority Leader John Boehner is crowing.
I want to extend all of the current tax rates. And that's what the American people want.
While that battle heats up, a bill designed to open up credit to small businesses and award them for hiring new workers is on track to pass the Senate today.
The Tea Party is getting involved in Washington's political infighting. Speaking on Fox News last night, Sarah Palin had this to say about Karl Rove, who dismissed the ability of Tea Party candidates to do well in November.
I have nothing against Karl Rove personally. You know, he's the expert. But, Bill, some of these folks, they are saying that people like Christine O'Donnell and others, Tea Party Americans, can't win because they don't want them to win.
Earlier, we spoke to Kevin Street, the leader of Delaware's Diamond State Tea Party. He told us the reason his party is doing well is because people don't want part-time conservatives.
They're looking for somebody who is going to be conservative 100% of the time and not just some of the time.
In the Gulf of Mexico, officials say a relief well should be completed sometime today, with BP's blown-out well being finally sealed by Sunday.
Finally. And a government report out today says the deepwater drilling moratorium in the Gulf has not increased unemployment in the region. It was imposed by the federal government after the BP oil spill might have temporarily cost 8,000 to 12,000 jobs. That was the estimate, but the report found no net job loss in the region, due in part to the big hiring push for cleanup crews. Latest round of Mideast peace talks have ended with no agreement on Israeli settlements. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank this morning for one-on-one meetings with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
And felicidades, Mexico.
Viva Mexico! Viva Mexico!
That is what is known as El Grito in Mexico. That is President Felipe Calderón delivering El Grito to celebrate the country's 200th birthday across the capital.
Oh, for ghetto. Everything bad that's going on in Mexico.
They're allowed to celebrate their 200th birthday.
They absolutely are. Yes, indeed.
Hundreds of thousands of people flood the streets, blowing horns, dancing alongside a parade. But, of course, drugs violence is heaviest in the cities. Festivities were more subdued there. El Grito was canceled in Ciudad Juarez for the first time in its history. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow starts at 10,572. The S&P at 1,125. The NASDAQ at 2301. Well, we're going to look at to the border between Mexico and America. Flashpoint, not just for the immigration debate, but a talk about fencing. We'll talk with the filmmaker behind a new documentary.
And a flood that may have changed the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. Coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
Well, we've talked a lot about the uneasy relationship with between Pakistan and the U.S. on The Takeaway. Obviously, there's a lot of anti-American feelings, despite the fact that the U.S. sends billions of dollars in aid to that country. And we've also talked about flood relief, how much the United States is doing, and whether that's changing attitudes. Yesterday, we checked in with Alim Makbul. He's reporting for us and for our partner, the BBC, as he journeys down the Indus River. And in a moment, we're going to get an official view of the changing relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan. But first, let's take a listen to Alim, check back with him with his latest report from Pakistan.
Along our trip so far, we've seen lots of groups trying to fill the void when government aid can't be handed out, including Islamist groups, some of them linked to banned groups. And a lot of people are very worried that they are making gains in terms of winning over hearts and minds at a time like this. And also we've found, particularly in the Swat Valley, a lot of people telling us that where they had been anti-American before a lot of this, now that the American soldiers are involved, particularly in Swat, in ferrying people by helicopter backwards and forwards, their feelings about the Americans have changed very much for the better.
Join us now, Dan Feldman. He's America's deputy special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan and works closely with Ambassador Holbrooke. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I read this interesting piece from the Brookings Institution suggesting that perhaps the flood relief model is the model that the United States should use going forward in all of our relationships with Pakistan. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, I think the most important thing is that we are focused really just on the humanitarian crisis currently, which is really, as you noted in your opening, quite epic in its devastation. 20 million people impacted at this point, millions of homeless, and a territory impacted the size of Italy. So the what needs to be done immediately is still quite critical. We are starting to turn the corner, though, now as the waters are just finally starting to recede and moving from what we've called this relief period to the recovery and reconstruction period. The relief period is where almost all of U.S. government money has been focused today in assistance. This includes all the military helicopters that have evacuated, as you noted, over 13,000 people. Many of them in the Swat Valley have delivered over 5 million pounds of food. And of the $260 million or so dollars that the U.S. government has committed thus far, the vast majority of that has gone towards relief. It's the recovery and reconstruction phases that we're just starting to enter, and the reconstruction will be in the billions and billions of dollars.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, yeah. Alim Makbul has been reporting as he journeys down the Indus. He's talked about places where he's seen some banned Islamist groups moving in and bringing aid to people. People who say they don't really care who's bringing the aid. They just are desperate to get food and clean water. Does this concern you to see these militant groups moving in to bring relief?
Yeah, we actually think that many of those accounts have been pretty overstated. There's a huge amount of money coming in right now from the U.S. and from the rest of the international community. Over $800 million has been pledged by the international community altogether. The vast majority of that is going through international NGOs, domestic NGOs, UN agencies, and there's a very, very vibrant civil society in Pakistan, very credible, long-standing domestic NGOs, which are operating very well. Look, you've got 20 million people impacted, so is the opportunity there for a number of groups to take advantage of this, including some extremist Islamic groups? Yes, but we haven't actually seen that play out as much. They've obviously said that they've been more involved than we actually think they have been, but we think a lot of that is rhetoric, and we've seen really, really great work by the Pakistani domestic NGOs as well as the funding by the international community.
Dan Feldman, can I suggest a kind of cost-benefit analysis of what's going on here in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, if you don't mind?
Sure.
We've got an investment of a few hundred million in the relief effort, right? That has paid off extraordinarily in terms of a warmth in U.S.-Pakistani relations and in terms of the Pakistanis seeing the money being spent. It certainly argues that some of these billions in security aid is wasted.
I think we're conflating two separate things. This was the point I was getting to as we get into the recovery and reconstruction needs. These are going to be in the billions of dollars, and this is where we've actually started laying the framework for this over the course of the last 18 months since the beginning of this administration, and where we will go in terms of providing benefits to the flood victims is already very much in line with the thinking and planning that we've been doing in conjunction with the Pakistani government. So most critically, when Congress passed the Kerry Lugar-Berman legislation last year authorizing $1.5 billion in assistance to Pakistan for each of the next 5 years, we are just starting to spend some of that money. And when Secretary Clinton has been out there the last two times over the last year, she has announced some initial projects in key sectors, hospital refurbishment, dam and energy refurbishment, water needs, agricultural needs. All of these obviously are even more critical now after the floods. And so as we try to redirect some of that money to both these main, these large sectors, as well as meeting the needs of flood victims as soon as possible, I think you'll see a convergence of the relief efforts as they turn into recovery and reconstruction and our longer-term partnership with Pakistan.
Well, I imagine that Dan Feldman will be thinking not just about Pakistan but Afghanistan this week, as well as Afghanistan heads into parliamentary elections over the weekend. So thank you for joining us, Dan.
Sure.
Dan Feldman is America's Deputy Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And let's check back in again with the BBC's Ali Makbul. So far, he's given us some pretty vivid pictures of what life is like near to the Indus River. And this morning, he's actually on the river.
Well, the litter left hanging in the trees gives you some indication of how high the river got. This is the Indus that we're on, the body of water that flows the length of Pakistan and whose path we're following this week. It looks very calm now, but just 6 weeks ago, it was a raging torrent that destroyed so much on either side of it. Now, I'm on this boat with Nasir and his son Jahangir. They own this boat, and they also own a house just on one of the banks here in the village of Mari. But just like so many places we've already seen on our journey, that village was pretty much destroyed. Their house is just on this bank over here and has been reduced to just rubble. There are some buildings that have just about survived, but theirs has disappeared completely. Now, what Nasir has told us is that there has been some aid come their way in the form of food, but no money so they can rebuild their house. But he also says that he feels very lucky, especially when he considers that there are many in this village and many more that we've already heard from who've had no help at all as yet.
Haleem Makbul in Pakistan reporting for us and for our partner, the BBC.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We're hearing so many stories about the Great Migration after our conversation with Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration.
Time is getting on, boy is getting scared.
I didn't learn about the Great Migration from my grandfather. He was just one of the silent, determined millions who left the South because they wanted their full rights of citizenship. For him, it was the promise of a college education in Ohio. For others, it was an assembly line job and $5 an hour in Detroit, or voting without fear, living where they chose, saying what they pleased without the danger of violent reprisal, and raising their children far from the swinging shadows of corpses hanging in southern trees.
I pick up my life and take it with me, and I put it down in Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, Scranton, Harlem, any place that is north and east and not Dixie.
Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri. He moved north with his mom while he was still in grammar school. Turns out the North and the West weren't the colorblind nirvanas many blacks imagined, but Chicago and Cleveland were a far cry from Birmingham and Atlanta. Our listener Della Beaver talked about this yesterday.
For him and for his family, they saw the opportunity in the North that they did not have in the South. And the other thing is that my father was someone who would not allow people to treat him less than a man.
Della's dad didn't talk to her about the Great Migration for years and years, and it got me wondering, why don't our families share stories of it? Why don't we see this event for the earth-shattering shift that it was? Well, partly because it stretched out over 5 or 6 decades. It was a trickle that became a flood. But it's also because this was a leaderless revolution. No soaring speeches from Martin Luther King or gut-wrenching music from Marian Anderson to draw national attention. Still, it was perhaps the most powerful civil rights movement this country has ever seen. Talk about nonviolent resistance. Millions of people decided they would not live in a place where they couldn't enjoy all the rights of an American citizen. And so they packed their things and started fresh in Pittsburgh and New York and Indianapolis. For some, it was a risk even to leave.
And then they mentioned something about some APC sit-down strike. Took me on down where they had me, where they tied me in a tree. And they beat me up until they thought I was out. And they hang me up in a tree, and one of them said, if I try to escape or get the gag out of my mouth to holler or something, he'd come back and kill me.
Well, how long would you say that they beat on you?
Probably about 30 minutes.
Southern states passed laws prohibiting blacks from leaving. They levied fines of $25,000 against anyone caught recruiting black workers away from the South. Policemen waited on railway platforms. They arrested any African-American holding a suitcase. Maybe Southerners realized what would happen to Dixie after their working class left. In some ways, the South has still not recovered from the mass exodus of its workers and the loss of cheap labor. And believe me, the migration brought its share of downsides. Kim McLaren writes to us that a lot was gained, but there are some who argue something important was also lost, she says. The great August Wilson used to insist that the migration deeply damaged black folks, disconnecting them from the land they'd earned with their blood, sweat, and tears, and leaving them rootless. As someone who grew up in the South and often still feels like an exile here in the great cold North, especially Boston, I wonder about this. And African Americans didn't leave prejudice below the Mason-Dixon line. This comment from a Pennsylvania woman was all too common.
If more colored are allowed to move in, Levittown is going to go downhill.
And these sentiments have an eerie echo today in the battle over illegal immigration that's stirring passions throughout the country. That's complicated by matters of citizenship, though. And for African Americans, they were already citizens. But they still had to take an incredible leap of faith to leave their homes behind and escape to unfamiliar lands. Here's our listener, Della Beaver, again.
It took a lot of courage, especially for my mother to get up and leave all that she knew and all of her family to come here and make a new life. But I tell people all the time, I am proud of my family all the way back through history. I am the second generation in my family who was born into freedom. My grandfather was a slave. And if not for this strength, I would not be who I am today and I would not be where I am today.
The country wouldn't be what it is without the Great Migration. Diana Ross, Bill Cosby, August Wilson, Toni Morrison, Nat King Cole, Miles Davis, all products of the Great Migration, as am I. I am the descendant of immigrants. For a moment, let's forget the migration from Africa that was violent and tragic. Let's instead take note of the journey that blacks took that was intentional. The exodus of citizens who demanded full citizenship, the journey of farmers and clerks and doctors and lawyers who insisted they had the right to work and live as they pleased. The Great Migration made America a richer, fairer, better place. Maybe it's time we all start talking about it, no matter what color we are, and celebrate the bloodless revolution that made us who we are.
I pick up my life and take it away on a one-way ticket. Gone up north, gone out west, gone.
Wow. You suddenly hear in that aimless kind of Miles Davis a search for roots, a traveling kind of notion of finding
like
an anchor.
Yeah, it's like the perfect little background for Langston Hughes's voice saying gone. That poem is he wrote in 1947 at the height of the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, you know, one of the things you've captured here, really, I think, and Isabel Wilkerson, I think, has touched a nerve of, it's kind of a greatest generation moment for African Americans thinking about what their parents did in picking up in these faceless, nameless moments and carrying these bags north to start new lives.
And I love the fact that it's really a story of immigrants. That's really, again, this is a different kind of immigration story, but for a country of immigrants as such as we are, except for Native American descendants, obviously, this is a story of all of us, really. Mm-hmm. We are all immigrants, and this is just a different twist on the immigration debate.
Well, all of us are weighing in. We've gotten great stories. Della's story was amazing, and people have been weighing in at thetakeaway.org. You're a part of this experience. You know how to reach us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share your story of the Great Migration or how it's affected you, or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. So what is happening politically this week? The Tea Party had a successful primary night on Tuesday. You'll recall that the biggest news came out of Delaware, where Tea Party candidate Christine O'Donnell defeated former two-term governor and nine-term congressman Mike Castle to win the GOP nomination for Senate. Not the first Republican incumbent to go down this hunting season. The Tea Party's calling it a hunting season. The Tea Party wants us to believe that this is democracy at work. The primaries are delivering a referendum on the identity of the conservative movement in the United States. This is what voters do, they tell us. But the Tea Party is also an example of some unintended consequences of the primary process itself, which you'll recall was created to legitimize the preferences of the party bosses who used to make the decisions on candidates at party conventions behind closed doors, the cloakroom idea. Kate Zernike joins us, a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. She's also the author of Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. Kate, good morning.
Thanks, John. Hi.
So how do we contextualize this? Are these unintended consequences from a primary system that seems to be as vulnerable to manipulation as the old conventions were? Or is this democracy at work, as the Tea Party people would have us believe?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at it, that everyone, you know, that people have a responsibility or a choice to vote. I mean, you know, they're getting out there, they're getting people to the polls. And so, you know, this is democracy. This is what happens. I certainly think the Tea Party people, you know, this is what's so amazing to me is that for months people have been talking about the Tea Party. You know, what do they mean? And, you know, they look at their crazy signs and they talk about, are they racist? And I think behind the scenes, the Tea Party's just been organizing. They've been planning for these kind of victories for months now. And we're just seeing that come to fruition.
Are these new participants in politics, or are these defectors from various movements within both the GOP and the Democratic Party, in your view?
Well, I think that, you know, it's really hard to paint the Tea Party or any movement, of course, with a broad brush. But I think a lot of these people are new political activists, not necessarily new to politics. There are some of them who are brand new to politics. There are others of them who, you know, are just sort of disaffected Republicans and have been involved in politics before. I don't think these are disaffected Democrats. I don't think they're even necessarily independents. I think they tend to be Republicans and conservative Republicans who want to move the party to the right.
To what extent, Kate, do you think this is just an extension of Republican organizing tactics in the past? The Republicans, one of their national strategies has been to kind of energize people to vote by encouraging anger, and that perhaps that the Tea Party is an outgrowth of that.
I think that's a mistake to see this as just an, I mean, in fact, if anything, I think, and I think I say this in today's piece, I think it's a mistake to see Christine O'Donnell's win in Delaware. I mean, that to Christine O'Donnell's win in Delaware, to me, says the Tea Party is not AstroTurf. Because even the groups that everyone accused of playing with that, of creating this AstroTurf grassroots movement, like FreedomWorks, they didn't endorse Christine O'Donnell because they didn't think she could win in the general election, and they want Republicans to win. The Republican Party did not want Christine O'Donnell. So this is our clearest message yet, that the Tea Party and the Republican Party don't go hand in hand. And so I think this is definitely something different that we're seeing. This is anger among Tea Party members. This is not just a Republican front group.
Right. Now, I don't know if you want to connect these two, but I can certainly recall, because I'm just a wizened old man, that you know, Ronald Reagan was viewed as something of a total insurgent and a wacko who could never win, and then suddenly he was the Republican Party. Is this unprecedented, what the Tea Party is doing, or an old pattern?
Well, I think it's an old pattern, and I talk about this in the book a little bit. I mean, it's an old pattern in that we've seen it before. I think the Tea Party actually compares more to the sort of the early Goldwater movement, mm-hmm. in that a lot of the Tea Party people don't want to talk about social issues. They think that the Republican Party has sort of been led astray in talking too much about social issues and not about economic issues. That said, if you think about the Goldwater movement, they really got very little traction until they joined with the social conservatives, and that ultimately ended up in the election of Ronald Reagan. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, you remember Glenn Beck a couple weeks ago had this big religious revival on the National Mall in Washington. So there's certainly a religious element within the Tea Party. There's some overlap, but I think if they banded together, it would be a lot stronger force.
Well, broadening out, you know, we've got evidence that in some sense the Tea Party is a tiny kind of blip of what may be a real ideological shift that's taking place among all kinds of voters who are changing their relationship to government. Listen to what one of our listeners said about their own reaction to what's going on politically this week.
This is Gabe in Augusta, Georgia. I find myself moving farther to the left as I hear about these individuals moving farther to the right.
It's a conversation we got started on The Takeaway at 877-8MY-TAKE at thetakeaway.org. How does that make you feel, Kate Zernick, to hear someone say that?
Oh, I absolutely think the polarization in this country is getting worse. And, you know, I talked to someone yesterday who said that this may end up actually, that there are independent voters, truly independent voters out there yearning for something in the middle, and that this, as candidates move to the left and to the right, thinking that that's where the voters are, this may actually open up a role in the middle for third-party candidates and for self-funders. Now, we know that third-party candidates don't usually succeed, but this may, in that way, this may be something different, because I do think that there are still a lot of independent voters out there.
Ultimately, if this is about anger at the establishment is Barack Obama in the White House. What good does it do to take down the party not in power if you really want to challenge the establishment?
Well, I think, you know, it's one of the people I profile in my book says if you want to get rid of before we get rid of the Democrats, we have to get rid of the Republicans. They think the Republican Party has not been choosing the right candidates, has not been focusing on the right issues, and they think that if they can get their people in there and get more of their voice heard, that they can push the Republican Party in the direction they want. So this is a long-term goal for them. I mean, this is something that they are in. They don't think of just the 2010 midterms. They think of 2012. They think of 2014. I mean, they're in this for the long haul.
All right. I'm going to throw you way out on a limb. I'd love to do this with you, New York Times folks. What would you tell the GOP this morning? Embrace the Tea Party or come up with some sort of countermeasure?
Oh, no, I think you got to embrace it. This year, I think you have to embrace it.
Whoa, a definitive answer. Kate Zernike, reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and author of Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. Kate, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So keep the conversation going. Go to 877-8MY-TAKE. How ideologically does all the political headlines this week affect you? Are you moving to the left? Are you a part of that polarization Kate Zernike talked about? Or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
Here's a message for all America.
人民币升值解决不了中美贸易逆差的问题。
So just in case you don't speak Mandarin, I'll give you a very...
My kids tell me this lesson. They're taking Mandarin in the
They're just offering
school,
Mandarin
in
the Jersey schools, too. Right. But anyway, here's a brief, basic translation. Try what you want, but it won't work. We're happy with how much our currency is worth, even if you're not. That's the message from China's foreign ministry. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is the guest of honor at day two in hearings that are designed to force China to revalue its currency, the yuan. The U.S. claims China is keeping its currency as much as 25% to 40% under its real value, and that gives its manufacturers an unfair advantage against imports, and it makes Chinese exports even cheaper. Here's Republican Representative David Camp. He's a ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, and he took China to task yesterday.
China must address its woefully inadequate protection of intellectual property, eliminate subsidies to Chinese companies, remove harmful indigenous innovation policies, end its restraints on exports of raw materials and rare earth minerals, and eliminate the myriad other barriers to U.S. exports.
Joining us now is the BBC's business correspondent, Mark Gregory. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
You know, we heard from economist Peter Morici saying the Obama administration isn't doing enough to address the devalued currency of China. But I'm wondering, what can the U.S. do outside of these hearings where they talk about it? What can they do?
Well, there's a bill before Congress at the moment, the Currency Reform for Fair Trade Bill, that's backed by Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan and has been co-sponsored by 132 others, which would give the Commerce Department the authority to impose a range of much higher tariffs on Chinese goods, or indeed any country that America considers to have its currency undervalued against, which is producing goods considered to be injurious to American industry. So that would give it fairly kind of carte blanche powers to impose punitive tariffs. Now, there's a lot of opposition to that, and it seems unlikely, but it's certainly a measure of the degree of feeling in Congress over this. Of course, other measures that the U.S. government could do, it could whack in a lot more complaints to the World Trade Organization, complaints about unfair Chinese trade practices, and indeed the administration launched a couple of those yesterday.
I imagine the temptation when the United States is still in economic trouble to blame an outside agency for that is pretty high. But what's the credibility of the claim that the Chinese is actually responsible for a certain extent for putting a damper on the American economy?
Well, it's clear that China's currency policy means that its currency is about 40% undervalued against the US. But of course, a lot of economists say that that's only a very small part of the reason why America is in effect exporting jobs to China. Essentially, Chinese wages are so much lower than American wages that actually minor movements in the currency probably may not make a great deal of difference.
So China says absolutely not, we won't consider it. Is that kind of the last word?
Well, no, this is an ongoing dispute that, of course, has been going on for years. And what happens is that the Chinese make minor policy concessions. Just in the last couple of days, they've allowed their currency to rise a little bit. A big thing is coming up on October the 15th when America, the government, issues its regular reviews of currencies. And it may be possible this time that China will be declared to be a currency manipulator, which could lead the way to very much more draconian American policy.
Mark Gregory is the international business correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
And now we conclude this hour with a look at another kind of migration, not perfectly legal like the Great Migration we talked about earlier this hour, but probably as socially significant. In the middle of the 2,000-mile border between the U.S. and Mexico is a 700-mile, more than $3 billion, wall. One attempt by U.S. politicians to try and control the huge migration of undocumented workers from Mexico and point south into the U.S. The border fence is at once massive, preposterous, pragmatic, and an immediate flashpoint in the U.S. debate about immigration. Before I built a wall, poet Robert Frost once wrote, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out. Good questions, and those questions haunt a new HBO documentary that airs tonight entitled simply The Fence, directed and produced by Rory Kennedy, who joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Rory.
Good morning, John.
What is The Fence?
Well, The Fence, as you say, is a 700-mile wall on the southern border, and its goals are to reduce the number of immigrants coming into this country, the number of drugs coming into this country, and also the number of terrorists coming into this country.
And Bill Odell, you can see the fence from where you're sitting right now out there in Hereford, Arizona.
That's right.
What's it look like?
It's ugly as usual and doesn't work. Your comments on Frost's comments, I just add that, you put a wall up to keep people or things out, you better be watching it. And if you're watching it, why do you need a wall?
That's so perfect.
It's an apparent deal that the feds have put up, and it doesn't address the issues at all. It just does not work.
Well, Bill's sense of, I think it's fair to say, bitterness or cynicism about the wall, I think, is all through your film, The Fence. Why did you decide to make a film about this object? It seems to me it wouldn't necessarily be a natural for a documentary.
Well, it touches on a lot of issues that I'm very passionate about. It touches about issues about immigration. I think it's really at the heart of who we are as a country, how we respond to some of these questions around immigration, questions about how we're going to handle the drug war, how we're going to handle the war on terror. And it's also, I think the film is trying to hold the legislators and policymakers in our country accountable for their actions. Is this really just a symbol, $3.7 billion it's already cost us to make the fence? It's going to cost an estimated $49 billion to maintain over the next 25 years. So is this really effective policy, or is it a symbol? And if so, it seems to me a very expensive one, especially during a time where everybody's, you know, watching their own budget. And I think we should ask our government officials to watch the government's budget.
You know, Bill, let me ask you, how far are you from the fence and from the border?
Well, our home is 385 feet from the actual fence. I'm over at my brother-in-law's now because we don't have a landline out there, but we have a half mile along the actual border.
Do you feel unsafe in your home?
You mean like if I was in...
The fence was built to protect people like you. That's part of the reason for it, right?
That's my point, Celeste. It isn't. It doesn't work. We've seen people climbing over it or going around. They can even go around it down at the river, which is only a mile and a half away from our home.
You know, Rory Kennedy, the irony of this film and part of the humor of it, and it's a little bit twisted, is that this pragmatic step, I think people, when they think they're building a wall, they're doing something very down to earth, actually plays much more as a symbol of how almost pointless our immigration policy seems to be sometimes.
Well, the fence has not reduced the number of people coming across the border. That's the fact of the matter, and it hasn't reduced the number of drugs coming across the border. So that was its stated goal, and there were no terrorists who came across the border, so it hasn't reduced that number. So I think on a very practical level, it hasn't worked. And then it also, you know, it's obviously, yes, it's a symbol, but it's also a symbol, I think, about who we are as a country and who we are as a people. And do we want to be a country that creates walls and creates fences? I always grew up feeling that our country was opposed to walls and fences. I think most Americans have. So I think, you know, that is going to define us and is defining us as a country and as a people. I think people need to be aware of it. There are a lot of people who don't even know that this fence exists, let alone how ineffective it is. And unfortunately, it's all the more tragic, too, because there's been such an increase in the number of deaths of people who are now trying to cross over the border, who are being forced to go into more isolated and very rough terrain. And dying in the process.
What do Mexicans think of this fence?
Well, Bill, I'm sure, has some insight into that, but in my experience in traveling along the border and the southern part of the border in Mexico as well, they're greatly offended and I think hurt by the fence. You know, this is a neighbor who we're not at war with, who is a friendly neighbor, who we have a really wonderful relationship with, and we're sending up this fence, which is really a symbol that says, we don't like you, we don't want you to be part of our country, we are at war with you, and don't come near us.
Bill, what message do the Mexicans get from this fence, in your view?
Well, Rory, at the beginning of her film pointed out, you know, the one coyote, the pollo, said, yeah, you put up one wall or two walls, it doesn't make any difference, we're going to cross. So when they have that type of attitude, nothing's going to stop them. And she's right, the immigration policy is what's not being addressed. People want to come up here to visit, to shop, to go to school, to look for work, whatever. In other words, people that we'd like to have visit up here, they can't really come through the port in a orderly manner, you might say. So that's what Congress continually fails to address. We've certainly got to stop this drug business. The wall has been effective as far as vehicular drive-throughs are concerned, but they've even circumvented that in some cases, mainly because our Border Patrol isn't forward enough. We need the Border Patrol on the border, not 3 miles back here on Highway 92.
Well, let me ask you, Bill, let's say, imagine for just one moment that President Obama appointed you the special advisor to immigration policy for the White House. What would be Bill Odo's solution to the problem that the fence does not address?
One, get Congress to enforce the laws that we already have in regards to visas, people entering the country, that kind of thing. I have no problem with checking IDs. I've got to do it when I want to write a check for something or that kind of thing. Number two, get the Border Patrol patrolling the border.
Bill?
Let's be effective on this thing. Let's not talk about putting up a, you know, as our former governor, the secretary now says, you know, when she was our governor, they put up a 50-foot wall, they'll have 51-foot ladders. Well, you don't hear her talking that way now. It's just kind of sloughed off. And we're tired of it down here, and that's why our governor, Governor Brewer, and our sheriff of this great Cochise County, Larry Deaver, they're wanting to enforce the law because the feds aren't doing it. I would change it if I had the authority to do it.
Bill, you're a movie star now. Don't you think he sounds a little like John Wayne, Rory?
Yeah, he's so much better than John Wayne.
Don't do that to me, Rory.
All right, the film is about the fence, the main character in the film, the fence there on 700 miles between the U.S. and Mexico. It airs tonight on HBO. Rory Kennedy is the director and producer of the film, and Bill Odle is in it. He's a resident of Hereford, Arizona. Bill, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, and say howdy to the good folks in New York.
Definitely will. Rory Kennedy, congratulations.
Thanks, John.
You can see a trailer for Rory Kennedy's The Fence on our site, thetakeaway.org, where you can also give us a howdy.
And there's a lot more going on at the website. We have a conversation going about politics, and we're asking you if you have moved along the spectrum. Have you moved further to the right, to the left? Are you staying right in the middle or right in place where you were before? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.